Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 16th, 2001. In the fireside room this evening is Randall Mullins. Today's session number is MUR 2001-9, and it's titled Beyond Just War and Pacifism. Let's listen in.
If someone can let me know it promptly at 7:15 that we need to stop. I need to make a little bit of a sudden getaway to get to Vespers tonight to be a part of that. The Vesper service tonight will be based on some of this material, so that should be good. There's other Wink material you can look at, including another curriculum by Vern Rossman, and then that little box on the handout on there at the bottom in that three-point typeface. There's websites that will take you, web addresses that will take you to some more. I like to try to start and end with something that gives us hope. So let me read this. This is actually from Wink's book called Violence and Nonviolence in South Africa. Most of you know he wrote this in 1986, and it had a lot of impact on the choice of South African church leaders to choose nonviolence in their strategy to overcome apartheid. But when he was writing this book, the Philippine Revolution was to overthrow Marcos in the 80s was very fresh. So Wink was able to draw on that to speak to South Africa about it. So listen to this. One key to the success of the nonviolent victory in the Philippines was the degree of participation by the church's top leadership in nonviolence training. A year and a half before Marcos was toppled from power, Jean and Hildegard Gosmeyer of the International Fellowship of Reconciliation were invited by Filipino Christians to come to the Philippines to hold seminars on the gospel and active nonviolence. These seminars lasted 6 weeks and included one with 30 Roman Catholic bishops. Richard Dietz, also with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, followed with 3 weeks of training primarily for Protestants. Out of these seminars, a group of Filipinos founded ACAPCA, Action for Peace and Justice acronym. Within the year, ACAPCA, under the leadership of Father Jose Blanco and Tess Ramiro, held 40 nonviolent seminars in 30 provinces with the cooperation of many Filipino bishops, clergy, nuns, and lay leaders. At strategy sessions, which regularly included Cory Aquino and Cardinal Jaime Sin, various scenarios for protecting against election fraud were discussed. When the crisis came, ACAPCA and other organizations had trained 500,000 poll watchers who were prepared to give their lives to prevent falsification of ballots. 500,000 church members were trained and were willing to give their lives to keep that election from being fraudulent. Later, when key military leaders defected to a rebel army base, Cardinal Sin, who, by the way, had been a supporter of Marcos and then went over to the other side, went to three orders of contemplative nuns and told them, "We are now in battle. Prostrate yourselves, pray and fast. You are the powerhouse of God and central to the battle. Fast until death, if necessary." Then over the Catholic radio, Cardinal Sin called upon the people to place their unarmed bodies between the defectors and the government troops. There were only a few in the beginning, but soon hundreds of thousands of people made a human wall around the base, tying yellow ribbons on the gun barrels of tanks and offering soldiers gifts of food, candies, and garlands of flowers. President Marcos ordered the tanks to attack. Their commanders refused to proceed when nuns and priests sat in front of their tanks. Pilots ordered to bomb the rebel base with its human cordon refused and defected to a nearby United States military base. And one of the colonels who had defected remarked, he says, "I thought the military was supposed to protect the people. Here the people are protecting the military." And I heard Richard Dietz speak a couple of years ago, and he was able to interview one of the colonels who refused to fire on the crowd that had gathered, and he said, "Colonel, why did you refuse?" And he says, "Well, I looked out of my tank, and there was an old woman in front of it with a flower in her hand, and it looked like my mother, and I just couldn't do it." And so, you know, this is a revolution for people who are, I think the minimum age for the leaders of this revolution ought to be 70 or something like that, you know. So, well, just a story that is too seldom told, that I don't think is known by too many people. Tonight I want to try to give you some basics, enough for conversation, about just war and pacifism out of Wink's chapter called Beyond Just War and Pacifism. He's trying to get us to something that is neither, and we'll try to get to that. You've got on your paper there most of, but actually there's a couple more. The criteria for a just war. What is, and this has roots that goes back to Augustine in the 5th century. It must be for a just cause. It must be waged by legitimate authority. It must be formally declared. Congress must, in this country, that would mean Congress issuing a declaration of war, as happened in World War II. It must have a peaceful intention. It must be a last resort. It must be the last thing you try after you've tried all kind of other measures to solve whatever the conflict is. It must have a reasonable hope of success. Its means must be proportionate to its ends. You know, that would just mean if you've got someone who's holding up one building, you don't blow up the whole city to do that. I mean, that's an extreme example. And these three, I think, I didn't get on the handout that you have there, but non-combatants must be immune in the fighting. The war must be waged between military personnel, and the targets must be military. Prisoners of war must be treated humanely. Treaties and other conventions that have been passed must be honored. So those are criteria for a just war. But have you ever heard of just rape theory? What's the criteria for a just rape? There must be some. Nobody's heard of that. Just child abuse. Under what conditions is child abuse acceptable?
I couldn't think of any.
Well, obviously with Wink, I'm being tongue-in-cheek here. There's no such thing that I know of. But isn't this interesting right from the beginning that anytime there's a war, you have rampant child abuse and rampant rape, but war's okay? But where are the Christian criteria for just rape? Well, that's one part of it. The other thing Wink does for us in this chapter is he points out kind of four categories of war. I'm sure we could come up with some more, but one kind of falls under the category of a crusade or a holy war. That would include the crusades of the Middle Ages. He believes it was include World War I. You know, there's that sense of we're all right and they're all wrong and we've got to do anything to win this battle. And in the Hebrew scriptures, in the Old Testament, many of those were holy wars waged on behalf of Yahweh, so it's certainly in our biblical tradition. Other wars are political wars of national self-interest. And then there's some other wars that he calls ego and machismo wars. One of them was Margaret Thatcher and the Falklands and the Malvinas in the 80s. He puts Saddam Hussein, who so staunchly refused to get out of Kuwait, and also George Bush in the same war, and, you know, sort of making the Persian Gulf War of 91 such a personal battle between him and Saddam Hussein, as he called him. And then finally, just wars. Let's just play with this a little bit from your own memory, and, you know, we're not pretending we're PhDs in history or anything like that, but let's just see what you think, and we don't have to agree on anything, but Can you think of some wars just out of your mind that would come under these categories? Let's say, let's just start with political national self-interest wars. What wars come to your mind that might fit there?
The Mexican War?
The Mexican...
Mexican?
Texas War.
Say it again?
The Mexican-Texas.
Mexican-Texas, okay.
Mm-hmm. War of Independence?
Yeah. Revolutionary War?
Vietnam.
Vietnam? I'm not sure you can't see all that, but we'll try to get it out in conversation if you can't. Anything else?
Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Soviet invasion of, you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay. Crusades, holy wars. Just skip around here. What? Anything come to mind to put under there? We'll say the Crusades themselves, if I think have got to go under that.
The American Civil War?
What about the spread of Islam?
Many battles fought under Islam, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I don't know those wars as well, and I'm a little embarrassed that I don't. Jihad, it's a much misused, I have a friend, a Palestinian Arab friend, whose name is Jihad, and at first, for my image of that word, I thought, why would you want a name like that? It means holy war, you know, but that's not all it means. Mm-hmm. How about ego machismo war? We've put, now you may not agree with this, and I'm not trying to start a fight here, but Margaret Thatcher, Saddam Hussein, George Bush comes to mind.
What was that war we had down there in Argentina, off those islands there?
Yeah, that's the Falklands, that's the Falklands War.
Grenada.
Yeah, and Wink said he and his wife, June Keener Wink, who is a force in her own right, said they were in, when that war started, they were in Argentina. And everyone in Argentina, theologians, church leaders, felt that Argentina was being overrun by the, you know, the empire, and that they felt that they were right and justified in going to war. And then soon after that, and all the theologians agreed except the Esquivel, the Nobel Peace Laureate. He was the only one who said they shouldn't use violence, but he really, he felt that some of it. They went to Great Britain, and all the theologians in Great Britain felt the same way, that Britain was all right, everything was justified, they had to do it. You know, so, and he says that's the pattern of wars of national self-interest, is everybody thinks the home team is right and just. So, well, how about some just wars over here?
There are none.
There are none is one opinion, okay.
Amen.
Anybody else? Anybody want to put World War II under here?
Yeah, I would.
Okay, World War II is a just war. Any more come to mind? Well, we don't.
Somebody put the Korean War in that category.
Korean War, okay. Somebody else might put Korean War in a different one, but we're not trying to be right here. We're just trying to listen.
Would Desert Storm come under any of those?
I'm sorry?
Desert Storm, would that come under any of
them? Where would you put Desert Storm?
I don't know. It just came to my...
Well, that's an important one because I want to talk about it in a minute if we have time. Where would some people put it?
Self-interest.
Political.
Mm-hmm. Political self-interest. Okay. And I just said, I put it over here because we use these three examples of the ego and machismo kinds of war. Just a kind of a way to think about this. But you all know about the theologians that got together just before Roosevelt asked Congress to declare war, and they looked at everything and said, this is going to be a just war. Everybody's heard about that?
No.
Okay. I'm being a wise guy today. I'm saying that because it has never happened in history that anyone got together certainly not theologians. You know, certainly Roosevelt didn't call in the Catholic bishops and the National Council of Churches. I don't guess they were formed yet by 41, were the Federal Council of Churches, maybe. And they asked, now help us decide, is this a just war? It has never happened once in history. And listen to this about World War II. World War II has almost been universally regarded by the victors as a just war. But no church body before or at any time during that war examined it in light of just war criteria. John Courtney Murray, the leading Roman Catholic interpreter of just war theory at the time, admitted that no sustained criticism of World War II was made before or during that war by Catholic ethicists. The traditional doctrine was irrelevant during World War II. So I think what we got when we say just war is we've got a kind of a vague general idea that we had to do it. But in fact, just war theory that was started by Augustine and then kind of handed down through history is a rigorous ethical discipline where, you know, you really have to look at it and satisfy the criteria. And I can tell you, I still can't name those seven criteria from memory, and I've been to seminary. And Wink believes there are very few theologians, Christian theologians, who can even tell you what the criteria for a just war is. So it's kind of irrelevant. It's kind of this vague sense of something in the air, according to him, that that really has never been used, and that we need to get beyond. So, and this is going to be we're kind of giving you snapshots all over the place here. I hope this will be fit together in a helpful way for you in the long run. But having said that, let's just look at the casualties of war. This is on your paper there, too. And the point of all this, if you just look at these numbers starting in the 1500s, more people were killed in war in the 1900s than in all these previous centuries combined. Wink really believes, I guess there maybe aren't dependable statistics going back to 3000 B.C., which he believes is the beginning of warfare, and there's striking archaeological evidence that there was a time there was very little war before 3000 BCE. So more people were killed in the 1900s than all the previous centuries combined in war. And civilians are supposed to be immune under just war theory. 50% of the casualties all the way through, up to 59 million during the 1900s, have been civilians. So that raises some questions for us. Well, I'm being pretty hard now. I'm leaning toward pacifism, but Wink's pretty hard on us too. He says pacifism has often meant passivity. That was really Augustine's position, is turn the other cheek meant turn the other cheek. He didn't see it as a way to fight, as Wink and now a growing number of others do. He didn't see Jesus as teaching the poor a way to fight. And it sometimes can make morality more important than justice. I want to be right, I want to be sure I'm pure, and I don't care how many people are being slaughtered by an unjust tyrant. And Gandhi was very clear about that. He says, if you have to make a choice between, if you feel like your only choices are passivity and violence, choose violence. And I just in preparation for today, we've been talking about Bonhoeffer all week. And probably many of you are aware that Bonhoeffer finally felt ethically he had to get involved as a Christian. He felt he had to get involved in the plot to assassinate Hitler. And what has happened, even in the classes up until today, is everyone has shrugged and says, well, there you have it. I mean, there are just times, I mean, that if you you know, Bonhoeffer's example just proves it. There's some time that reality just dictates that, you know, you got to choose the violent way. But what always gets left out of that is that Bonhoeffer thought what he was doing was a sin. He was also, during those years, trying to get to India to visit Gandhi personally. And Wenck asked the question, he says, if Bonhoeffer had known how much subsequent generations would have used his choices to justify violence, I wonder if he would have made the choices he made. We got a lot of questions going here, but let me just read one more thing from the Vietnam era from Paul Ramsey. Paul Ramsey was a strong advocate of just war theory, and during my years in seminary, he was still someone we were supposed to read. I'm not sure I read him very much, but I was supposed to have. But just listen to this paragraph. According to the criterion of non-combatant immunity, for example, civilians should be protected against direct attack. But this prohibits only, quote, the deliberate human act of intentionally aiming at civilians, not their foreseeable destruction collateral to aiming at legitimate and important military targets, according to Paul Ramsey, one of the leading proponents of just war theory. And Ramsey some more. There is no rule against causing the death of non-combatants, but only against intending to target them directly. If guerrillas chose to hide among civilians, then it is legitimate to blow up civilians along with them. No Christian and no moralist should assert that it violates the moral immunity of non-combatants from direct, deliberate attack to direct the violence of war upon vast Viet Cong strongholds whose destruction unavoidably involves the collateral deaths of a great many civilians. It was a Christian ethicist talking about Vietnam War. Yes, non-combatants should be protected, but if the U.S. Army is firing at a legitimate military target and they happen to kill some civilians, that's okay. That's not, you know, that's someone within our mainstream churches thinking about war. That's our heritage. Let me stop there and tell you, just share just a little bit about a more personal and, for me, much more disturbing example. I don't know if you are aware, I suspect most are not, because the media would never cover it as much as he tried. Ramsey Clark, as you know, was the Attorney General, son of a U.S. Supreme Court Justice, distinguished jurist, Attorney General during the Johnson administration. He got himself to Iraq during the war with a cameraman and did a lot of filming of what was happening there during the war. And after the war, he set up war crimes hearings in about 16 cities all over the world and found Colin Powell, George Bush, Dan Quayle, and the vice president, I'm blocking his name, which doesn't surprise me in one sense. What's his name? Our current. Dick Cheney, guilty of war crimes. Now, the media did not and would not cover this, and it was not under any official world court or anything, admittedly. But it was done with, you know, with all the integrity of a skilled jurist. Let me tell you what I know about that. I know that Dick Cheney designed the attack, designed the offense against Iraq, and one decision was to bomb out all the electrical substations in Baghdad, a city of 4 million. That disabled this desert city's water purification plant and its sewage treatment plant. That means the sewage of a city of 4 million runs into the Tigris River, which is the only water supply for all the cities downstream, including the city of Basra, a city of 1 million. Not only that, the disturbing thing for me is that, you know, those of you who remember World War II, and I'm proud of it even though I don't remember when it happened, is after World War II, we made friends and markets through the Marshall Plan after we defeated Japan and especially Germany, but in Europe. We immediately went to work to rebuild those places. After we defeated Iraq with less than 200 U.S. casualties, we immediately increased the sanctions against the people of Iraq, which has resulted in the unnecessary deaths of how many Iraqi children? Does anyone know the number now documented by UNICEF?
It's a little over 600,000, isn't it?
Yeah. At least 500,000, and it's probably a lot more. That's just the children. And so I went to Iraq in 1997, and this has been a major commitment of mine for the last 5 years. And I just bring that up not only in terms of just war theory, but in terms of the question now, have we become the nation that is most willing to commit genocide in the world? It took us 3 years to even get the Seattle Times editorial staff to even listen to what we felt was very well documented information by UNICEF, and also including Dennis Halliday, who resigned in protest his position as director of relief work for UN in Iraq on the ground. So we are in a place with some disturbing questions that I'm afraid we're not looking at. The greatest purveyor of violence in the world today is
military conflict.
Do you know who said that is?
The military complex.
Military complex. This is a quote from someone. You know who said it and when he said it?
Eisenhower? Was it Eisenhower?
Martin Luther King Jr. The greatest purveyor of violence in the world today is my own government. He made that statement at Riverside Church exactly 1 year before his death, April 4th, 1967. Within weeks after that, J. Edgar Hoover sent a memorandum to President Johnson saying, I can almost quote it, he is obviously someone who's in the hands of subversive forces and a serious threat to national stability. Then there was several efforts over the years to question whether or not James Earl Ray killed Dr. King, and a lot went on. And then in Memphis, in my hometown, December 1999, there was a little bit of news that made it to a few front pages. Anybody know what the news was? Anybody remember the, who was that football player who had a little trouble and may have killed his wife, and we're still not sure, O.J. Simpson. Anybody heard of that trial? It got pretty good coverage, didn't it? Do you know what happened in Memphis was that, forgetting his name now, but the owner of the diner out of which the guy with the gun came to shoot Dr. King, probably a marksman from the Memphis Police Force. Lloyd something, and agencies of the government were found guilty of conspiracy to assassinate Martin Luther King Jr. The witnesses in the trial included, there were 70 stellar witnesses, including four judges, five or six clergy, Andrew Young, Walter Fauntroy, and the jury in my hometown, and it's still a racially divided city, I can assure you, included four whites and four blacks, and the verdict was so, the evidence was so clear, it took them less than 4 hours to come back with a unanimous verdict.
Who was tried?
The way they had to do it legally, it was the one person they had evidence on who finally confessed on national TV was his first name is Lloyd, and he was the owner of a diner right there that overlooked, it was the place from which the shot was fired. So they used, he was an accomplice in it all, and he provided him access to his little diner so that the person who shot Dr. King could go outside and do the shooting. And he finally admitted that he heard a shot fired, someone came and gave him a gun, he was told what to do with the gun. And I don't want to prolong this too long, but all this is told well in a book called Orders to Kill by William Pepper, who was James Earl Ray's attorney and has paid a heavy price in his own life for standing up for this. But you see, my point is, when Dr. King, and what he did at Riverside Church in that speech, is he came out against the criticism of many in the black leadership across the country, came out against the Vietnam War. When he did that, there was a swift reaction by the government and a swift a conspiracy by the FBI, the CIA, Army intelligence. The evidence is just overwhelming to assassinate him. And when it was finally proven in court, we didn't even notice. The country didn't even notice, and most people still don't know it. So I'm playing a support role.
Wait a minute. This is sort of kind of hard to believe. It's so different from what we've heard. I guess I'd like to be convinced a little bit more that it really happened.
Okay. Well, about thousands of pages of trial transcript are at www.kingcenter.org. And if you want to read the whole thing and what the King family, what Coretta Scott King and Dexter King said at the end of it, that's the best I can refer to.
They advocated a new trial for James Earl Ray, so it would...
Pepper tried again and again to get a new trial for James Earl Ray, and it just kept on being blocked and blocked and blocked. And James Earl Ray, as you know, finally died in prison. And so the best they were able to do legally, Pepper just never gave up and finally got the King family to listen. And then that's when, I don't know if you know this, but James Earl Ray went on national news with Dexter King, and Dexter King said, "Mr. Ray, for the record, I want to know, did you kill my father?" James Earl Ray said, "For the record, I did not kill your father." And Dexter King said, "Mr. Ray, for the record, I want you to know my family believes you." Now that was on CBS News, somewhere back here. So.
Mm-hmm. I think everything we've been talking about here ties into the forum that we, film that we show Tuesday that we'll talk about tonight, because it seems as though war is not a thing in and of itself. Countries don't plot, let's go find us a war someplace. Military power is an instrument of foreign policy. And hopefully the foreign policy can be used skillfully so that the mere threat of military force is enough for the national will. When foreign policy is not done well, war is the result. It's not the intention, but the result of a failed foreign policy. Foreign policy is also an instrument of national policy. That's not a thing in and of itself either.
Mm-hmm.
Our national policy is to keep the economy expanding. Keep the stock market going up, keep people employed, keep making more and more stuff, as we saw in that movie. And so part of that is to have a dependable and cheap supply of oil to fuel that economy. That a lot of that happens to be in the Persian Gulf area. Stability of the Persian Gulf is a key national priority. When Saddam Hussein threatened that, it didn't respond to threats. War was the result, but it wasn't the desire to wage war that was the cause of it. It was the failed foreign policy and the national policy of we all participated in terms of keep the economy going. Well, that's our military power is used in support of that.
Yeah, a good concise statement of how economy builds into war. And other reactions from any point of all this, or reflections or questions that anyone wants to ask?
You know, I think many people, at least my first reaction when you hear something like this, is to, I kind of get this first view that says, well, conspiracy theorists, you know, you get going, you can make a case for everything. But my second reaction, and I don't know anything about the King assassination, but I did spend several months some years ago doing research about executive secrecy in the United States government. And it scared me. You know, I mean, I don't remember World War II, but I remember the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. The Turner Joyce in Seattle, one of the destroyers. And there's very reliable evidence that says that there were cables from commanders on the ships that said, we don't know what's going on here. We don't know what happened. That cable came from a military commander in the Gulf of Tonkin, and it was suppressed before the vote in Congress.
Yeah, armies are organized to take things. They aren't organized to defend. They're organized to take things. I mean, that's the history of our military regime. You wanted to take it. We did the cavalry take in India, and you know, you can always find an it to go up against. It's a depressing society, because I think that the military industrial complex that Eisenhower was worried about, and so was Truman, dictates. You want a new weapon, to try out a new weapon, you find a way of using it someplace. I mean, that's how I understand the military regime that we're under.
It seems to me, in my mind, you bounced over a lot of things without filling in some of the blanks and cracks in there.
Yeah.
Iraq, for instance, President Bush at the time, 1 year ago, he said in 2 more weeks we will have Iraq completely destroyed, as far as we will have them under our control. And the United Nations says, no, we got to quit right here. And if we'd have had the opportunity, and if we'd have done that, we wouldn't have had all these kids you're talking about killed and all this and that stuff. And then with a big percent. What?
I'm not aware of this UN vote.
UN vote? Mm-hmm. Oh, and that's why we quit the war. We got Kuwait back, and the United Nations said, hey, that's it. We don't. Oh, yeah, very, yeah. Big news all over the country here. You must have been taking a nap.
Well, I could have been. I'm
not sure that's exactly what happened.
That is exactly what happened. The United Nations said, stop now, Mr. Bush. We're not going to go and go into. He wanted to go into Iraq and finish him off. In 2 weeks, we'd have been done with it. And then we wouldn't have had to worry. A big percent of our oil that we get in the United States today comes from there.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the U.S. position was to leave Iraq strong enough to fight Iran, who was also our enemy. You know, kind of a crazy policy, but they felt if they kept Saddam in there, he'd beat on the Iranians enough and we wouldn't have to. That's why he was left in power.
Can I try to bring the conversation back to Christianity a little bit here?
Yeah. Well, then McNamara, again, you've heard of him. Uh-huh. He's the one that got started over Vietnam. And then after we had how many 100,000 of our soldiers killed off, he said, gee, that was a mistake. We really shouldn't have gone to war over there. So we kind of backed off and left the country. Well, it was nice of him to change his mind there after we lost hundreds of thousands of our soldiers. You know, anybody want to argue about that?
Yeah, he should have done it a lot sooner.
Well, we should never have gotten in there in the first place. That was a joke.
Well, let me see if this prompts any different kind of responses. From the time the church began, 30 of the common era to 313, the time when Constantine became emperor and we were Christians were suddenly in charge, the church opposed war and violence in all its forms. Around 170, there's records of some soldiers who, Roman soldiers who converted, they did stay in the army. There's debate over whether, you know, just war people say, well, the church was pacifist or non-combatant in that time because of worshiping idols in the Roman, you know, the Roman worshiped the emperor and so forth, or because they really did believe in nonviolence. So this is where we were the first three centuries of the church. We pretty strong records, and according to Wink, nobody really argues about that. Just war people don't say that's not really true. The church really was unequivocally nonviolent until 313. Let's see if we can come to the scriptures just a little bit. Can you think just, and we're not trying to be biblical scholars here, but and we may even have different ways of what we mean by being faithful to the scriptures, but do some scriptures come to your mind that that kind of undergird support just war and some scriptures that undergird nonviolence? We're not getting to any one conclusion here. We just want to listen to each other. No. What scriptures come to mind that say either one?
Turn the other cheek.
Love you,
for nonviolence?
Yeah.
Or just war? Okay.
About thou shalt not kill.
Did somebody else say something? Love enemies?
Yeah, love your enemies.
How about some for just war? Any scriptures come to mind that support just war? New Testament I'm talking about now.
Kind of vaguely, render under Caesar what Caesar's.
Okay.
He doesn't want to make him take it.
Any more scriptures come to mind?
Well, a bit of Revelation.
You need something?
Well, I mean, Revelation talks about it, I guess, and everything.
All the battle reports and the warfare done in the Old Testament when Israel in the name of Yahweh destroyed the Canaanite cities and
I was talking primarily about what Jesus taught in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, clearly there's not just war, there's holy war all over the place. Mm-hmm. I'll just tell you though, Wink believes as a New Testament scholar that Jesus unequivocally did not teach just war. Jesus taught nonviolence, but he did not teach passivity. Jesus taught a way to fight, as we've already talked about in our a number of our other sessions this week. So all this together is my way of raising the questions for Christians. Now we can speak as armchair diplomats in realpolitik, and I like to do that too. But if I'm trying to say, what does the Bible teach, and what do the moral questions of our time invite me to in light of the Scripture and what the Spirit is saying to me, I'm finding that I have to say that in terms of reality, in terms of Scripture, that I have to ask the question, is Jesus calling us in this time to an unequivocal commitment to nonviolence? What do you think? Is that possible, or is that just too unrealistic for you?
You should be able to sit down at a table and solve your problems without going around shooting people. Mm-hmm. Whether you're in the army or because when it's all over, look at Japan. You know, they bombed us and this and that. And so we went to war with them and this and that. And in the end, what do we got? We're friends with theirs again. And this, you know. And then they asked Clinton, Errol Slick Willie, if he would apologize for bombing Hiroshima. Mm-hmm. You know, that made me laugh about as much as the Pope here, Pope John Paul here, a couple of months ago, making a big apology for the German deal. You know, and that made me actually laugh out loud when he did that. What's the deal? Give me an explanation on that.
Christian,
I don't know about that. Larry, you had something.
You don't know about that.
No,
you didn't even hear that.
No, it has to do more with Christianity. That the apologies have to do with attempting to heal the past. Jubilee. And it's a jubilee.
Well, for the Holocaust is what he was apologizing
right.
for.
Sure.
But what's the deal? Give me an explanation. I don't get it. I laughed out loud when I heard him.
Because they did not stood by silently as the Jews were being marched off.
Yeah, so what good is it to do now, 50 years later, to apologize? That's what made me laugh. There was no action at all taken at any time.
There are still people bleeding over it.
You know, I can shoot somebody and then a couple of years from now say, gee, I really apologize for that. And that's okay then. That's good.
Yeah. We have to deal with people who are bleeding. There are people who are still bleeding with this thing. And
But your feeling was the apology was really purposeless.
Well, that's exactly right. And I laughed out loud when I heard it say that.
Excuse me. Can we get some other people have some things to say here. Can we move on?
Larry, did you? Yeah. When I was 18, I was forced with the choice of whether to go to Vietnam or not. And it's something I refused to do. But I've always wrestled with it. And I guess what I don't have answers to is how do you handle someone like Hitler? I mean, it seems that at some point, pacifism breaks down. I mean, and I don't think, I mean, we've got World War II label as a just war, and I have a hard time believing it, but at the same time, I don't know what the answer is for someone like Hitler.
Raising more, kind of building on that to a current situation, now maybe this idea some would disagree, but it seems to me we have three or four so-called rogue states in terms of Iran, Iraq, North Korea, Libya, which anyone is not out of the realm of possibility at all. One of their leaders might someday fire a nuclear weapon at Israel or somebody nearby. Mm-hmm. What is the path if that happens with 100,000 or more deaths and there's what do we do? I mean,
May I respond?
That's a different question. I mean, it's a different situation. It's the same moral question than by, say, a guerrilla warfare or toppling an unjust dictator like the Philippines, South Africa, and so forth. What if a state decides to uses nuclear weapons this way? What is the Christian answer?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If in Germany all the Christians had said they will not follow Hitler and were willing to die, he couldn't have done all that.
Yeah.
Is that what you mean by nonviolence?
Larry, but in light of that, you were here yesterday, and I won't repeat them now, but actually nonviolence did work against Hitler in six or seven situations, not to oversimplify World War II, but a lot of untold stories when it did work.
Randall, I've got three more minutes till quarter after you asked.
Oh, thank you.
I don't think it's possible to be a little bit nonviolent or to protest this war but not this other war. I think it takes a radical change in direction. I was living in Pennsylvania up until January and had some contact with some of the historic peace churches, the Amish, the Mennonites, and the Quakers. And they live out nonviolence, not only in refusing to serve in the military, but truly a nonviolent approach to life in every aspect. And for those who say, well, that's not practical or Christians can't do that, the Amish have been doing it for 200 years and prospering and living not violently, walking gently on the earth.
And the Quakers, and in my newsletter this time, we lost a UCC member, you know, loss of membership in churches. Kathy Railsback was a lawyer at Microsoft and felt God calling her to do something. She was a member of a UCC church in Seattle. She joined the Mennonite church and went to the Christian Peacemakers boot camp, I call it, a month-long training for Christian peacemakers. It's now done in Chicago by the Brethren, the Church of the Brethren, the Mennonites, and the Quakers. So we've got a place now to train Christian nonviolent soldiers, fighters, to deal, and there, many of them are going into conflict situations such as Bethlehem, the VA cases where Kathy was. Jim, you have.
I just wanted to make a minor point. When we say that World War II might have been a just war, and the reason we're saying that is primarily because of the Holocaust. That, you know, it was a good idea to try to predict the Holocaust, but at the time we didn't know about it.
We didn't know about the Holocaust.
But we did. But we did.
Yeah, we did know.
There's lots of evidence the U.S. government did. In fact, I think the death camps didn't even exist at the time we declared war. Is that right?
No.
There's quite a bit of evidence the U.S. government.
Every government knew about it.
Thank you for coming. Tomorrow we'll talk about the gift of the enemy, loving our enemies, and focus on that. And we can continue these conversations outside in other places.